I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You've had a few controversies online.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The Lydia Millen has been blogging for over a decade. Lydia's story is full of twists and turns. She has often stayed quiet on this and very, very rarely does interviews.
My palms are really sweaty. One of the things that I think I've struggled the most with communicating online is my childhood.
What were you like back then? I've heard that you spent summers in Ibiza.
I had a job at Ibiza Rocks, Plastic, Eden. I would go from one job to the other and then I'd go out and I'd party.
Where do you think that desire or enjoyment of earning money came from?
For me, it all links back to I learned really early on that I couldn't depend on a lot of people.
How do you deal with the criticism?
I've been on the receiving end of cancel culture. See, I've lost count of how many times I've experienced it. I'm not about to feel sorry for myself.
Do you think you have like an online persona?
Such a hard one, isn't it? Failing in the way that I did, I didn't know how to cope with it at the time and it floored me. I didn't know enough. That's the long and short of it. I have never felt shame like that.
If you could do it all again, would you be an influencer?
I think that...
What is up, guys, and welcome back to Working Hard, Hardly Working podcast. Today, we have Lydia Millen on the podcast. With a combined following of over 3 million on social media platforms, Lydia has been blogging for over a decade. Lydia began her journey in 2011, documenting her outfits as a student. Then, after a crucial repositioning towards kind of high luxury content, this expanded into huge online success for her blog, YouTube, and social media content. Lydia's story is full of twists and turns. She's gone from achieving 3 GCSEs at school to moving out of her parents' house and in with her grandmother and now building a life she says she's always dreamt of, which she shares with her followers online through her kind of opulent videos. Lydia has reflected on her past in her new book, Evergreen, published in October. Now look, it is no secret that Lydia has been involved in kind of public controversies in her years online and has faced significant backlash as a result of her content. Lydia has often stayed quiet on this and very, very rarely does interviews. So I'm very excited to be able to talk to her about this and her whole career and kind of her whole life online today. I consider that a huge privilege for her to feel comfortable enough to be in this space, to talk to her about it. And having done this interview, she really opens up on kind of what that's felt like, but also what she feels like she's done wrong or not got right in those times and how that's developed her as a person and as a creator and where she thinks she can be better, but also we as a kind of culture can have a better culture towards reacting proportionately to issues on social media. I really wanted to see a little bit behind the curtain into the Lydia Millen, her life, what it's like behind this online persona, whether she feels like she has an online persona, and really get into the kind of nitty gritty of that in this episode. I feel like we always try and have really interesting conversations with really interesting people. And I think that it's so often kind of this idea of like controversies or cancellation, it's so often shied away from. And I think perhaps that's what lends it to being such an explosion when it happens. Lydia's approach to it was really, really open and honest today. And I'm hugely grateful to her for allowing me to kind of dive into that a little bit more. So I hope you really enjoy this episode. As always, if you do enjoy it, please make sure to like, subscribe, rate, review, send it to a friend. But thank you so much. And I hope you really enjoyed this episode as much as we enjoyed recording it. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm very excited. I feel like we have a lot to talk about and I am very grateful for you coming on here. I'm going to get straight into it. I always ask guests about their early life, their childhood, generally because I feel like it's very important in who we turn into today. So I'd love to hear a little bit about what your childhood was like.
I think this is one of the things that I think I've struggled the most with communicating online is my childhood, because my parents were together for 5 years. When they split, it was almost like two worlds happened. So my mum moved into a rented council house and my dad moved into a really luxurious man pad in Northwood. So when I was at mum's house, it was a very, very different experience to when I was with my dad's side of the family. Only in the last few months, I would say a year, that I realized that that's actually really confusing for me, because I'd explain to people, oh yeah, so I lived here. No, well, I also kind of lived here. And I also, yeah, we went to our holiday home here, but mum didn't have that holiday home. So it was a strange one. And I think it's definitely been interesting understanding that I kind of felt like I had a really lovely experience in those first 5 years. And then it got really confusing. And I've just never really been able to communicate it in a way that even makes sense to me.
Right. And I think if it doesn't make sense to you, then it's very hard to communicate your kind of feelings about it and how it cemented your kind of understanding of the world. Because I always think that, like, when I talk to guests about how their understanding of the world was formed and how their understanding of kind of where they stand in that world, like, even as you were saying, like, did we have a lot of money, or were we stretched, or were we kind of actually incredibly privileged, or whatever it might be? And your understanding of the world is, I mean, most of the time it's developed by what your parents were like and the environment you grew up in. Mm. I can imagine growing up in two very different environments would have also created two very different sides of you in a kind of understanding of what it's like in either one. Mm. How did that form your kind of aspirations?
I would say that the way that I navigated it was, I kind of started romanticizing my life in whatever iteration it was in at the time. And I think that's something that has really stayed with me throughout my entire life, from, you know, buying my first home or where I was there in my first career to now, is that I was like, I kind of don't know where I am here. I don't know where I am here. So I'm just going to make the best of what's here and always make the best of it, no matter what situation it is. It's meant that I've always felt really content. Mm. And then when life gets better and I aspire to something new and I move into that stage of my life, I find contentment there. And I'm like, this is nice. This is more than I ever expected. But buying my first home, I never imagined that. My mum's house was bought for her by my dad, and I never imagined I'd be in that position. And so I really sort of romanticized this house that was like an ex-council house, where my wardrobe, and I used to call it my walk-in wardrobe, I could stand in it. It wasn't a walk-in wardrobe, but that was my next step. That was what I was aspiring to. So I was creating that happy place there in the house, in the situation that I was in, because I kind of had to navigate understanding where I was at that time and the limitations of where I was at that time, and then hopefully aim for the next stop.
And am I right in thinking you moved in with your grandmother?
Yes. Yeah, I did.
Could you tell me a little bit about that?
When I finished university, I moved back to where I grew up. I had quite a strained relationship with my mum in the early days. I think that's kind of a girl thing, but I think I held a lot of animosity to her then, which I don't hold now. I moved in with her. It really wasn't great. And I was sort of at this point where I was like, I don't know where to go. I've got my job here. And my grandma took me in. And I think that that was the moment where I really, like, that was where I got focused, because she's such an incredible woman, like the most formidable woman I have ever met. Gave me structure. She would listen to how I was finding my new career. And I talked to her about my blog as I'd started it. And she was very supportive, which wasn't something that maybe I'd always got from my mum. And so I had this experience of, like, the mum that I hadn't had. And it was a really sort of formative few years for me. I think I was there for 2 years. It's where I met Ali, my husband. I look back on those days and I'm like, wow.
You talk about being at university and kind of graduating and what that was like. What were you like back then? I know I've heard that you spent summers in Ibiza. You've talked about, like, the difference between you then and now. I'd love to hear a little bit more about kind of, like, what was Lydia like then?
Ibiza was so funny for me, because I think that there's this, like, misconception about why people go there for their summers. But I was working 3 or 4 jobs when I was there. I was there to work, because I loved it. I loved the environment. I was like a Duracell bunny. I'd work throughout the day. I had a job at Ibiza Rocks, Plastic, loads of different places. And I would go from one job to the other, and then I'd go out and I'd party, and then I'd get up the next day, go to the beach for a little bit, go to work, go to the next job, and just do it like that all the time, because I knew I wanted to have fun. I liked making money, and I've always liked making money. And so that was a way of me doing two things. I felt independent. I felt comfortable. I was earning enough money for me to be able to go and buy myself like a nice perfume. I wasn't, you know, living in a flat that wasn't a nice flat when I was there. And I lived a really good life when I was there. So I was able to enjoy myself, and I'd go home with money in my pocket, and I'd go to university, and I'd be able to then do my two jobs at university. I think that's where I learned how much I enjoyed making money. Mm. And I enjoyed that. That was something that gave me a lot of purpose. It gave me a lot of focus. One of the jobs that I did, I worked solely on commission. I'd never done that before. You know, I'd worked in some fairly normal teenage jobs growing up, but this was the first time I'd like, it was my responsibility for me to get paid. And that was probably the most money I'd ever made in my life. And I was like, oh, wow, what an experience. Okay, so it's not scary as long as I put in the work. And so it went on to affect my time at university, because at university, again, I worked two or three jobs when I was there. Even though I liked to go out, I liked to do the student stuff, that wasn't why I was there. I was slightly older as well. I was 21 when I went to uni. So I was working in a bar, I was working at Topshop, because I still wanted to live a nice life and enjoy it.
And where do you think that desire or enjoyment of earning money kind of came from? What was it that it gave you that you think motivated you further to make sure you made more and compromise other things?
For me, it all links back to independence, because I feel like I learned really early on that I couldn't depend on a lot of people. And so if I had enough money for me to do things, if I had all of my ducks in a row, I didn't have to depend on anyone. And I remember it took me a few years to pass my driving test. And so I used to depend on someone like my mom or whoever to drive me around. And that, just having that where someone could hold something over me, I think that's where it came from, that I wanted to not have to depend on anyone. And I think that that's something that my husband has had to learn to really understand, because it, when I'm in any kind of situation where I feel vulnerable, I very much close down and I just focus on self-preservation, whereas I think most people look outwards and look for support. I'm not like that.
So let's talk about the beginning of your online presence. Mm. How did that come about?
I think for me, it was it came from frustration, because I was at university and I really wanted to be working in fashion, and fashion at the time was like the girl's career goal. That's what you wanted to do. And I wanted to be a fashion buyer, and I couldn't get on the course. So I was frustrated. I was studying something that was very, very helpful, but it wasn't keeping me inspired. Mm-hmm. And I had always had websites. I don't know if you remember Homestead. It was like Homestead, where I taught myself to code and I built websites and I would just write on them.
Incredible.
Before blogging. This is like when I was 16. So I knew what I was doing, and I saw that I think it was like the age of Lily Melrose and those kind of girls, and I was seeing what they were doing. I was like, right, okay, I can take pictures of my clothes on the floor, not even thinking to actually wear the clothes. I just like put a jumper on the floor, like really like this jumper, and then write about it. And then I was like, oh, wait, maybe I should wear the clothes. That's great. And then there was lookbook.new, which was kind of like Facebook for fashion. And I started posting on there, and I saw quite a big sort of uptake on that. It just kind of went from there. And then I realized I was working at this on the weekends. I wasn't being paid then, but I loved it and I enjoyed it so much that I kept going at it and going at it. And I probably worked on it for like 4 years before I ever got paid, which is fascinating to see how far it's come now. Like, the industry is just so different. And so my audience kept growing. Even when I pivoted and changed, my audience still grows today, which doesn't happen often. So I do think that it was just sort of like a natural progression, but I worked hard at it. I'm lucky that I come from a family of many entrepreneurs. My brother has done amazing things, and I always have a nod to this. What he said to me was, if you're not working until 2 a.m., Lydia, you're not working hard enough on your business. Before I was doing YouTube, I would be writing my blog posts, and I'd pour my heart and soul into those blog posts, and I'd be falling asleep at my laptop at 2 a.m. and just constantly working at it. I'd have an idea for a video, I'd film it there and then, and I was constantly trying to be at the forefront, the most content. Back when the algorithm really kind of championed mass content, I just worked really, really hard. And then the jobs started coming in and I thought, wow, okay. I remember turning to my husband one day and saying, like, this is a really unique position we're in, because we get to invest our time and see if it pays off in a monetary way. We don't have to invest huge amounts of money in this. And I really didn't in the beginning. It was only when I had my first big pay packet that I took that money instantly and I invested it in a Canon 5D. It was actually the same amount of money that I put down on my first mortgage. So that was huge for me. And that was the first investment I ever made in it. And it paid off. And then I was filming videos on that camera and it really elevated my content. And I think that's the thing, you have to sort of catch the eye of brands and businesses. The next thing I know, I'm sat with some of the biggest beauty brands in the world having breakfast at Claridge's. And I was like, I'd never been. I was like, this is amazing. Now that I look back, it feels like it was like a skyrocket. But in reality, I've been doing this for so many years that it feels like a natural progression as well. So weird.
And your content is luxury focused. What was your decision behind choosing luxury?
Luxury is really subjective. And so I thought that my first house was really luxurious. We painted the whole thing white. We had really lovely furniture in there that, you know, I managed to get a good price or whatever. And so really I was just talking about the lovely things in my life and sharing what I thought was lovely. That's obviously progressed as my career has progressed. But those moments of luxury is something that I didn't realize that I was doing quite naturally and making often quite mundane aspects of life, like, you know, doing your hair. There's a way to make that a really wonderful experience. And cooking dinner. I always say whenever I cook a meal for my husband and I, I'm like, I get to cook this meal. And so for me, it's always been just about highlighting those elements of life. Sometimes, and very much in my early days, that did focus around the handbags, the shoes, the cars. And whilst that's still an element, I've learned that there are so much more. And I talk about that in my book, and it's very much a balance. I find a lot of purpose in working, earning money. That's a lot of purpose. But I may not find my happiness there, or with the money that comes from that, or the things that come from that. I may not find my happiness, but my purpose is there. My happiness comes from the other things. And so it was just generally sharing that those were the things that I enjoyed talking about. So that's what I did. It wasn't really, I feel like we didn't really think about it as much as we think about it now, as like, you know, what's your content strategy? There wasn't really a content strategy back then. It was just, this is what I like. This is what I'm interested in. And at the time, especially on YouTube, nobody was talking about the handbags because it was still that very young market, kind of what we see on TikTok now, whereas TikTok is now in that progression that YouTube went through. That was what I did on YouTube. I was like, I kind of know that I want to watch this stuff. I want to know what's, you know, a nice handbag to have. I want to know where to shop for XYZ. In a month, I gained 50,000 followers, which at the time was very quick. Nowadays, we see numbers much bigger than that, but at the time, that was very quick. And the appetite was there, so I talked about it more. And I do think that that's very much what my audience enjoy. They like to hear about the nice things, some of them as an escape, others because genuinely they're looking to buy something. There's always a side of the audience that maybe it's not right for them, and I understand that. I try to do balance. I don't always do it very well, but I try. Definitely noticed that things changed when I moved to my house that I'm currently in. So whether it was the me in Ibiza or whether it was the me in my old house, I think it was better received, me talking about the expensive handbags and things like that. It was better received when I was in my old house. I think when we moved house, it got quite intense for a while. I understand. I do understand as well. So it is, whereas I think I'm just sharing the natural progressions of life, sometimes that can be stifling for other people, and I get that. Like, I think that it's not easy to watch somebody change and then also maybe feel like they're at a different stage in your life. Like the frustrations that come from that, I can only imagine.
Right, whether perceived as better or worse or further along or less far along. Like, I've had creators that I've loved at university, and then they got engaged and then they started families, and I actually was kind of like, you're not disappointed, but you're kind of like, oh, I really related to that content. Yeah. And now I actually can't find that replacement elsewhere, because it's actually probably one of the only industries where direct replacement is really quite tough. But I think it's so interesting because it's the walking a line of making sure you're evolving in your career and also your personality and who you are, whilst also thanking people and appreciating that they were there at a very different time. Mm. And that's going to be, at the very least, annoying that something you liked changed.
Yeah. One of the unique things about the industry is that a lot of the time your audience is very passionate. I am so grateful for that. And like part of me often make, you know, I feel like, oh God, I wish I could have stayed that person that you took so much joy in, but I can't. I am somebody who really loves evolution, and every day I learn something new. And even just, you know, in recent years, I feel like the whole world has gone through such a huge transformation recently. And I have changed the most since we went into lockdown. That was my biggest shift.
Right.
And I knew that that was going to be uncomfortable, but it is. Like, growth is uncomfortable. We know the cliche sayings, like, growth is uncomfortable. And comfort zones, nothing grows there. So we can all stay in them if we want to, but that's not the person I am. And I'd like to think that some people will take the good from showing the evolution as well, just like I take the good from your evolution. I'm so grateful that you do so much for women in business, like genuinely, hand on heart. The stuff that you've been sharing recently, just, I know, congratulations on your very big day with, is it £1 million in an hour?
It was.
That's on, like, but I hope you realize that you talking about that is going to be creating a space for women where they can talk about that, because I know I've never felt able to talk about my monetary wins, and when I've never felt comfortable. So the fact that you're doing that means that there are going to be women in future that feel comfortable to show up with that kind of energy. So this side of you now, I'm so grateful for, because you make me feel comfortable in just even acknowledging so many things in my business that usually I'd be like, you know, we used to be so scared that people would find out how much I charged. Mm. Like I lived in fear that we were going to get an email from someone posing as a brand and that people were going to find out how much I charged. I don't want to live like that. And so when you do things like that, you really are helping so many people to be more comfortable with things. I feel more comfortable.
Thank you. Thanks. I literally knew the second I shared it, I was like, this is going to come back to bite me.
The reality is that when you're having an amazing time in the sort of public eye, it gets hot. Lots of eyes are on you, lots of opinions. And it's the same with, you know, the last month that I've had where I've launched my book and I knew that it was going to get hotter. But I've had to learn over the years how to get comfortable in those situations and have processes in place. I don't know if you have like processes in place for how you deal with it, or whether you're just like, nah, got it.
I don't expect it, but I also do expect it. But I also don't think I can really prepare for it.
No.
So I generally kind of roll with the punches. I know what I feel like I did right, what I feel like I did wrong. Mm. And I'm pretty happy with that. Mm-hmm. I want to, as a woman, show business success. I can't complain about the position I'm in. I do know that the negative of that is going to be the fact that it makes people very uncomfortable, whether for justifiable reasons or not. I know it will. I know that it wouldn't make people anywhere near as uncomfortable if I was a man posting about that million an hour. And I know that no one would think that was going into my pocket, a man posting about their business doing that, which it's certainly not. Even if it was, I would still have a right to post about it. But I do think that that's kind of the reality. And if you're wanting to challenge things and you're wanting to be known as someone who did some things first, you're also going to be pushing some uncomfortable buttons, and you have to get comfortable with that.
Yeah.
I like to not try and think that I'm always getting it right. In fact, I very publicly get things wrong sometimes.
Can I just say I'm grateful for that too?
Thank you.
Like genuinely though, like this whole world, this whole digital world that we're experiencing now where people can follow us along with things, it's born because we wanted that human to human connection more. We'd had the celebrity endorsements for so long, and they were just untouchable, airbrushed images on magazines and adverts. And the reason why this has happened, and this the birth of social media in this way has happened, is because we wanted human. We wanted more of that, so we wanted the messiness. But we're sort of in a funny stage now where we kind of want the human, but we don't want the mistakes. And I think that the more we share the mistakes and the failures, and I think that's something that is happening more. A lot of people are talking about this more, whereas before you didn't want to talk about where you maybe got it wrong or failed at something. Now we talk about it and openly. And again, these things make some people uncomfortable, but I think that you've got to be the person that stands up and says, I'm going to be part of the change. And as they say, first over the wall gets the bloodiest, and that's what you're experiencing now. I think that's a saying, or I might have just paired two different sayings together to make
it kind of make sense. Yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
I know you speak in the book about kind of what people see on the outside is quite different from what there is on the inside. Could you talk a little bit more about that? And do you feel like you have an online persona?
I almost feel like my online persona has almost been taken out of my hands. Like that narrative has almost been taken out of my hands to a certain extent. And I would say that I've definitely, in recent years, there's more of me now. Like on my YouTube channel, I'm much more candid, and I show very much my sense of humor a bit more. I definitely struggle on different platforms. Like I'm not one of those people that like turns it on and they're like, ah, blah, blah, blah. I'm not like that. I'm like unexpectedly funny when I do things. It just comes out. No, I can't. It doesn't translate well quickly in on other platforms. I would say, on some platforms, I may be perceived as almost like being like a perfectionist and perceived differently. If someone wanted context around me, they could definitely go and find it. I'm much better at sharing who I am and what I'm about and the things that really matter to me on my YouTube channel. That's where, you know, my videos are an hour long. You can get acquainted with me. I think that now I need to bring more of myself to other platforms. And I think that that's where there's maybe a different perception of me, which I am sad that would be, because I think that there's a lot of good that I do and I work hard and I'm doing my best. And I think that I'm quite open with a lot of things that happen in life, and I share a lot, and I'm quite a vulnerable person. I don't know how to be guarded online. I don't know if you're good at that. I'm not good at that.
I'd love to know, what does your daily routine actually look like? Like I kind of want you to make me feel better here about my personal, you know, the aesthetic of my personal daily routine. But I'd love to know like what it actually looks like.
I think that I struggle a lot with routine because my job is so here, there, and everywhere. One day I'll be in another country. One day I'll be in bed, you know, getting a lay-in. And so I have to have structure. One of the things I've learned about myself recently is that if somebody puts something in my diary in the middle of the day and there's nothing else before then, I don't know what happens to me, but I can't move. I can't do anything until that, because I'm so scared I'm going to miss it, that I just sit there and I'm like, I could do this. I've got an hour, but I don't want to start doing that. So I've had to really get quite good at having a succession of things before I undertake anything in the day, so that there's, right, okay, this is what's going to happen here, then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to get to that. So I do have to have a lot of routine, and I want to give you the comfort that maybe I don't have. Sometimes I don't have a routine, but for the most part I have to, otherwise I don't get anything done. And I know you share your routines quite a lot. You share your...
I operate like a child at school.
Yeah.
I must have a timetable at all times, and that is the only way I operate.
Yeah, I know that about myself now, that if I don't just even physically write it down, I can't type it on a phone. I have to physically write it in my diary, and that's how I work best. And I do struggle with not having a routine and not having the ability to have structure in the normal way. Like, I would love to have like every day where I get up 5, 6 a.m., work out, take the dogs for a walk, get ready for work, have to get ready for work. I can't, I'm not someone that can work in my pajamas. I have to get ready, makeup, hair, full outfit. But then I'll have an event that evening and I might not get home until 3 a.m. And then the next day I can't get up until 10 o'clock. And that's my whole routine that gives me my most effective, most productive days. That's all gone. And so I have to always on a Monday be quite strict with myself. I have my PT session always like scheduled in on a Monday so that I kick off my working week in the exact same way as much as possible. But yeah, routine is a big one. But I think we hear that quite a lot. I think that it depends whether you're an evening person or a morning person, but having a set routine really helps. But I will operate in a world where that you can't, it's not like I start work at 9 and I finish at 5. There are no lines.
You've spoken about the need for council culture versus cancel culture. Mm-hmm. Could you talk to me about that a little?
Well, I think we touched on this before and how a lot of the time our response nowadays is disproportionate to the issue at hand. I know I found myself in a number of situations where I've been on the receiving end of cancel culture. I honestly, I've lost count of how many times I've experienced it. I've had to understand the human response, the difference between, you know, being offended and harm and that kind of thing. And I've really wanted to look at this and understand it. And a lot of the time we're approaching situations that should be done through conversation, education, in the way that you would sit down with a friend if they said something or did something or made a mistake. You talk to them about it and you'd hope that they were able to hear you out and have a conversation. And instead, it becomes a very, very destructive environment online over things that, you know, most of the time, and absolutely, we need to hold people accountable for things when they're like, you know, crimes. You know, there are some really, really terrible things, and that's not what I'm talking about here. Mm. Like, those are very, very different. The general day-to-day of life that we talked about, like making mistakes, failures, it's in those moments where discussion, reflection is really where the council culture side of things rather than cancel culture is needed. Because it's just like when you're parenting a child, we've learned over the years that shouting at a child doesn't really help them much, doesn't really get the message across any quicker. Speaking to them, having the conversation and giving them the time and the reflection on it, that's where children flourish. And I don't know why we can't apply the same level to each other. But I do think it's just a culture that we're in at the moment, and I think that that will change. But it's got quite disproportionate to a lot of the things at hand. And whilst I understand that there will always be people that are hurt by things, and that's important to acknowledge, but I really like to think that we could talk about things a little bit more.
And as you say, you've had a few controversies online.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Personally, not a clue.
I'm afraid to.
Sorry, you've got the wrong girl. It's not me.
Those days where that's happened, mm-hmm. and you can probably see it boiling up, mm-hmm. and you can probably see something and you wonder whether that's going to be one that's going to go or whether it's not. Mm. Could you talk to me a little bit about what that type of day is like, or like the feeling, or what you notice, or any kind of similarities? Is everyone kind of different?
First and foremost, what's important that I say is that I never mean any harm to anyone. And I think that that's like something that I always want to like underline, is that my content is very vanilla. A lot of the time it's me, my dogs, my cat, my husband, me going to collect the eggs from the hens, me gardening. I might show you a few nice things. It's very, very vanilla. It's not a space where I necessarily set out to ever offend anyone. In fact, I want people to sit there with a blanket and a cup of tea and watch my video. That's how I envision it in my head. That's, I think, really important for me to say, because I never, ever want to offend anyone with what I say. And that really hurts me whenever that happens, because my Achilles heel is people not thinking I'm a nice person. And I've been very candid with that.
Tough job to be in.
Oh, yeah. And I was really vulnerable about this in the beginning. I was like, yeah, I struggle with people not thinking I'm a good person. And I think that that's potentially why a lot of the things that have happened have centered around me not being a good person, because that is my Achilles heel. And so in those moments, I'm naturally devastated, because I'd never want that. That's just not the type of person that I am. That being said, I've had to learn also who I actually am. in those moments when it's quite intense and there's a lot of opinions and a lot of the time a lot of stories that aren't true that come out, and you're just sort of like, oh God. I'm not about to feel sorry for myself. What I do is I understand the limitations of who I am as a person, and I dust myself off and I just hope that I can do better in the future. That's genuinely how I want to approach every obstacle. Nothing is the end. And I kind of hope as well that in the world that we're in, I always envisioned that I'd be like the sweetheart of the industry. That's definitely not me. But what I hope that I can maybe be is that, because this happens to so many people, we make mistakes, we're human. And I hope that other people moving into this space, other creators, perhaps they can see that there is resilience in that as well. And just dusting yourself off, knowing, okay, that was a tough one, getting better, doing better, showing that. That's what I really like to do, is to just show that I'm a better person for it. And it has made me a better person. Every single one of those situations, I can promise, I've always come back and I'm like, wow, that has made me so much better. I like myself more for getting through it.
You speak in the book about the idea of failed projects. Mm. As someone who's living online, mm-hmm. you've obviously got to be failing online. Could you talk a little bit about your experience with failed projects and failing online?
Failure is something that I have only just got comfortable with. I had no idea how to fail because I'd never failed. Like, I'd never experienced that at school. If I didn't think I could achieve something, I didn't bother with it. If I could achieve it, I did my best at it. So failing in the way that I did during the pandemic and launching my brand, I didn't know how to cope with it at the time, and it floored me. And now I can see it as one of the best learnings of my entire existence. But I wish I was more like you in that you're really good at confronting things there and then. I think that that's, and I have to go away and I have to dissect things. I have to understand. I can't do anything without understanding it. I need to be able to rationalize something, understand every element of it before I can talk about it. And I think that, and I wish I could be that person that responds in the moment and says like the right thing. But I have to understand it first. And I had to grieve for that project. It was, as much as it's been a few years, I poured a lot into that. Just like anything I do, I wanted it to be great. And it wasn't. I remember when my best friend was like, you've just said you failed for the first time. And I was like,
oh, yeah. God. What a day.
Yeah. No. Literally, I was like, oh. I had to go through the motions of grieving for something that I really thought was going to be great, because, you know, that was what we did. That was the blueprint. You became an influencer, you did really well at it, you launched a brand, and then you think you're Grace Beverly. And I'm like, but genuinely, I was like, I we're learning now that that isn't how it works. And actually, I didn't know enough. That's the long and short of it. I didn't know enough. And now I know more. And so hopefully, I can take the lessons of that failure and wear them like a badge of honor, because in the beginning it was a lot of shame. And now it's like, it's so fascinating to me to be able to turn something that I have never felt shame like that. And now it's like, yeah, love that for me.
That was great. Yeah. I personally had a great time there. And what did you learn from that experience?
I learned that I am a creative and I very much need people to rein me in on that element. I also learned a really, probably the most valuable lesson is about who you work with on things. And that I have taken with me into building my team now, because the ride has to be with really good people. I'd rather have a business that does all right and be surrounded by really epic people and say that we had a great time doing it than a business that's doing exponentially well and I'm surrounded by people that no one cares about each other, no one's interested in each other. I couldn't do that. I really love to be around people that I have a good time with all the time. And so that was one of my biggest lessons.
And so if you could do the whole thing again.
I wouldn't do it.
No, I'm joking. I'm joking.
I would.
But even looking at your whole career, mm-hmm. if you were back to 18, you're considering your next steps. Mm-hmm. If you could do it all again, would you be an influencer?
I think I confronted that very question even just recently, where I genuinely, for the first time, I thought, am I going to keep doing this? I 110% would do it again. I would. And I think that the price we pay in this industry is because we had the perk of being in it early. And as with any industry in its infancy, there are growing pains. There are areas where it doesn't work. It does work. We learn new things. I mean, we're still a completely, pretty much unregulated industry. There's no like governing body of influencers. We have it for the sponsored side of things, but not the actual industry itself. And so, of course, we're still learning. Any person can become an influencer of anything at the moment. And so it's really early. And I love the fact that I got to experience the early days, because the early days were magic. Before the cultures that we see now, honestly, I'll never forget my first event I went to. It was a Motel Rocks event. And we had a cardboard cupcake tower. And I have never enjoyed myself like more. And it was just amazing.
Thank you to Motel Rocks, yeah. Who is not sponsoring this podcast.
I'm actually wearing Motel Rocks. No, I'm not.
It's very on brand, Lydia. Yeah.
But it was. And do you know what I remember? Because I think Lily Pebbles was there, and she was working with, is it Birchbox at the time? And so she was like, you know, she was one of the very, very first wave. And I remember walking in, and it was just like, it was the golden age of this industry, where we were in the early days the sort of awkward girls and guys that I didn't really have a lot of friends at school, at uni. So I'd found myself online, and there we were in our awkwardness at a Motel Rocks event, and it was great.
With the cupcake tower.
Yeah, the cupcake tower. But it was, and it was simple. Like, it was lovely. And so I'm really happy that I experienced that side of the industry. It's not an easy thing to go through when you're going through the growing pains of any industry in that way. I do think that it'll grow and it will evolve and things will get better. I'm also not one of those people that's very talented, so I was always going to do something like this. To be honest, I hate it when people can, like, I said this in my video not long ago, like when an influencer can all of a sudden like play the piano or sing. I'm like, oh, you can play the piano, can't you? Oh God, you're not allowed to be talented. We're supposed to be talentless. Like, this is the only job I could have done, Grace, okay? And there you are with your piano.
To be fair, I'm shit at the piano now.
Yeah, no.
It's got really down.
But genuinely, I think that's the thing. I've really enjoyed the ride. The ups, the downs, and you've got to have the downs to experience the highs. And right. I've had some highs, like some incredible highs. I'm going to blow my own trumpet here. But like, I have. I've worked with some of the biggest brands in the world in my career. And like, I would never have ever had that opportunity. I tried to be a model. It didn't work. So I did this and it worked ish. And so I've had some amazing opportunities, and I wouldn't change it for anything. I wouldn't.
Well, I think that's the perfect place to end. Thank you for being so honest and open. It's really clear who you are. And I think that's really important in the midst of everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's clear you're a lovely person who means really well. And I think that's really
Achilles
all we can ask for.
My smiling right now.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Now that I'm starting to stop sweating, I've had a really great time.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Working Hard, Hardly Working. Lydia, I think we can all agree, was incredibly vulnerable and open. And as I said, she very rarely does interviews. So I'm so grateful to her for kind of trusting me with this conversation and trusting me in going further than a kind of profiling piece and actually talking about these specific things, because I can imagine that's not easy to talk about when those things have happened. So I'm really, really grateful for that. So thank you so much, Lydia, and thank you for subscribing and listening to this podcast. It helps us to get incredible guests and to have conversations that hopefully you don't see too much online. That's really my aim after all. Thank you so much.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thank you so much for supporting. It really means more than you know.